Not at home in America, today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. A Liberian refugee who came to the U.S. as a child has decided to go back. He's even giving up his American citizenship.
It's really hard to call America home. No matter how much money I can make in this country, whatever, I'm always going to be a black man in America.
Plus, Brexit has made for some messy British politics lately, but now Theresa May looks set to become the country's new prime minister.
We would love to believe it were a case of women coming up to clear up the mess that men have made. I think we all know that women are actually just as capable of making a mess.
And the outgoing Prime Minister David Cameron hums a little tune, which gets turned into musical gold. That's all today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Glad you could be here. We want to start today with an outsider's view of what's been happening in Dallas. Today, the memorial for the five police officers who were killed last week by a sniper. Two presidents were there to offer words of comfort. First, former President George W. Bush.
Today, the nation grieves, but those of us who love Dallas and call it home have had five deaths in the family.
And then President Barack Obama.
In this country, we don't have soldiers in the streets or militias setting the rules. Instead, we have public servants. Police officers, like the men who were taken away from us.
Unity is the theme of the day, but what does it actually look like on the ground, especially to someone who grew up in a different country? That's what we asked my BBC colleague David Willis. He's a correspondent based in L.A., but today he's reporting out of Dallas.
Yes, I think one of the most striking things about it all is that no city in America perhaps has felt the current backlash against the police quite like this one, quite like Dallas. Yet there can be few cities more united in certain ways than Dallas. I've been very impressed since I've been here with the extent of community policing introduced under David Brown, the current chief. It was hailed, of course, by President Obama as virtually the poster child for police reform, this city. And it's quite astonishing, really, the changes that have been made, given that this was this once had a higher per capita rate of police-involved shootings than, I believe, Chicago, Los Angeles, and New York. So very interesting to see the changes. Very ironic and tragic that what has happened here took place last Thursday.
Yeah, as you've been following these tragic and divisive stories of police shootings, do differences and similarities between relationships between the police and citizens here kind of echo the ways British police interact with people there? Have you been seeing or thinking about any of that?
The model here, the community policing model, is very similar in certain respects to that in England, putting the emphasis, greater emphasis on foot patrols, on officers interacting with people in their neighborhoods. And of course, what that does is it helps to build trust within the community. It makes the people of the neighborhoods more comfortable with the police. And also, of course, it helps officers to get information that can then help them solve crimes. And part of the outreach here in Dallas has been a boxing league for kids from the ages of 8 to 18. I went to see one of these in the Pleasant Grove neighborhood of Dallas last night. They've cultivated there, they told me, no fewer than 9 national champions in the last few years. Mm. And certainly speaking to some of the, 40 or so kids who go there every night after school, there does seem to be much less evidence of a sort of us versus them relationship with the police. Many of the kids told me that they liked and they respected the officers that they had come to know there.
Does Dallas feel different from Southern California, where you live and work? Because I'm sure that in both places, you've probably spoken with African Americans who do not trust the police, despite the attempts at community policing.
Yes, I mean, the policing models are very different. The cities, of course, are very different. And the means of policing here under Chief David Brown has been one very much based on greater transparency, introduction of body cameras and command staff being given racial bias training and so on. Similar in LA, although the system in LA seems to be based more around containment, the containment of those in a particularly bad area of town.
How long have you lived in the U.S., David?
16 years.
16. So, I mean, you've got a pretty good perspective. How would you describe the gravity of this moment as far as where this country has been and is headed in race relations?
It's very interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, for all that President Obama has said that the country is not racially divided, there clearly is a very real problem. And we're seeing these protests in one or another American city virtually every night now for more than a week. The stark warning from presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump that we could be in for a long and potentially violent summer. It's troubling. And hence, I think President Obama, anxious to break the vacuum that was created by his absence from the country, to come back here to address the issue head on and to provide, hopefully, a sense of leadership.
My BBC colleague David Willis in Dallas. We've been hearing a lot lately about what blacks have to cope with every day in America. Not just African Americans, but Africans in America, too. Our next story is about a man from Liberia. His family fled their country's 14-year civil war and came here to the U.S. as refugees. But now he's moved back to Liberia, and his mother is not happy. Heidi Shin has their story.
My name is Mercy Kura.
And I'm Jefferson Kura.
And this is your...
Oh, this is my mother.
And my son.
Mercy Krua and her son are trying to see eye to eye about something. It's about where to call home. She lives in Boston, but is a Liberian refugee. And not all of her memories of Liberia are good ones.
They didn't really care. They were killing everybody. And so it was really difficult. It was terrible.
But sitting on his mother's couch, Jefferson remembers it differently. He was just 5 years old when they left, and it all felt like an adventure. He says when they eventually arrived in the U.S., that's when life got hard. It was the 90s, and he was about to start middle school.
So when I came to America, we were living in a very bad neighborhood. One of my cousins was held at gunpoint.
Okay, here we go.
Could you lock it, please?
Oh, sure.
He takes me back to the housing projects in Boston, where he spent most of his teen years. He shows me the street corner where he was jumped and his cousin was mugged, all while the school crossing guard looked on. He was allowed to go from home, to school, to church, and that was it. And he kept his head in the books and made it to college, to Cornell, where he met other Africans. Not refugees, but wealthy international students. Here, it was cool to be African. The university housed a rare collection of journals where he learned about Liberia from scholars.
Like, I had to come to America and go to a remote place like Ithaca, New York, where I'm able to discover my people even more.
At Cornell, he studied civil engineering and set his sights on going back to Liberia. He'd heard of other young Africans who went to school abroad and were returning to the continent now. So Jefferson moved back to Liberia last summer, just after the Ebola crisis had ended.
Man, I wanted to kiss the ground. I was so excited. It's like everybody talks like, how you talk in your home. It's just a nice feeling to not be the other. I was really happy.
He launched a digital news outlet called The Bush Chicken. He's also working on a startup to bring a bike share program to Monrovia, where it can take hours for kids to get to school. But his mother still worries about him. It's like he's starting all over again, she says.
I'm concerned. I mean, almost everybody is out of there, and I don't have any, like, on-call or older person that I can really rely on to say, oh, Jeff is over there, you can look out for him.
For Mercy, America is the place that's provided opportunities. She worked long hours as a nanny and saved enough to finish nursing school. Now she works as a registered nurse and is a homeowner in Boston.
Right now, honestly, I'm from Liberia, but wherever I am right now, I consider it to be home for me.
She doesn't want to talk about Liberia anymore. The memories make her sad, she says. Instead, she proudly shows me a picture of President Obama and Martin Luther King Jr. hanging on her living room wall. But Jefferson tells me this story about a run-in he had with the police just in front of his mother's house in Boston not too long ago.
They're questioning me. One of them is so aggressive. He shouts at me. He says, "Why are you taking so long? Don't you know it's cold out here?" And as a black male in America, I am just scared. So with something like that, it's really hard to call America home. No matter how much money I can make in this country, whatever, I'm always going to be a black man in America.
But in Liberia, Jefferson is the 1%. He shows me photos of the resorts he frequents, the press badge he flashes that gives him access. He can even put on an American accent whenever he needs it, something that affords you respect in Liberia. His ultimate goal is to become Minister of Transportation, and he's even renounced his U.S. citizenship so he can enter politics there.
All my dreams, everything, all my goals, they're focused on Liberia. I have these nightmares where I wake up and just be sweating and just like, it's basically Liberia got into another war again, and that's a fear for me because I don't know what I would do.
But for now, he's embracing the opportunities his new home has given him. For The World, Heidi Shin, Boston.
Jefferson's nightmare is about war back home in Liberia. In the Bahamas, you could say one current nightmare is what might happen if you're a black Bahamian and traveling in the U.S. and get pulled over by American police. That hypothetical prompted the Bahamas to issue a rare travel advisory to its citizens visiting the U.S. Jerome Sawyer is a journalist in Nassau.
It just advises Bahamians traveling to the United States, particularly to the cities that have been affected by the recent protests and the shootings, to be very aware of their surroundings, aware of the protests that are happening, and to comply should they come in contact with police or find themselves in a precarious position. And I think that's the most important thing, just to comply with the police request. And if you find yourself in the middle of something that's happening, do what you're instructed to do, and more importantly, just to avoid any violence that you may encounter.
And is the advisory, at least in terms of being cooperative with police, is that directed at all Bahamians or men mostly?
I think it is directed to all Bahamians, but it does make reference to African-American men and the African-American male experience, and I think that is most important. You got to understand that Bahamians really travel a lot. We move around the world a lot, and of course, we're a predominantly black country. And so it's very easy for a Bahamian man to be mistaken for an African-American or a black man in America. And so there's very little difference sometimes until someone speaks and you recognize an accent. So I think it's something that, you know, they wanted all men, particularly Bahamian men, to be aware of.
What's your own experience traveling to the U.S.? And do you agree with the premise that if you're black in the United States, the police might find you suspicious, more suspicious?
I went to school in North Carolina in the 90s. And so I can very much relate to the experience of an African-American man and an experience with the police, who are sometimes profiling or may come from a particularly racist position. And so I understand that experience. I know what it is. I know what it is to be told a bathroom isn't working or to be looked at suspiciously or to be pulled over for no apparent reason. But coming from a particularly different cultural background, I think my experience as a Bahamian may have caused me to act a little differently because I don't sort of share that same cultural background as an African-American, but I can relate. I would have been in that position before. Even now, as a journalist, sometimes when I travel places, I'm treated differently. And so I understand, I can relate, and I know what millions of black Americans face every day. I would have lived it myself and sometimes continue to live that experience.
Is the travel advisory being taken seriously? I mean, have you spoken with people who are contemplating trips to the U.S. and are thinking about these things?
I don't think anyone would have canceled travel plans, but I think it does raise an awareness. And I think, more importantly, it brings home the seriousness of the situation. Whenever there is an event around the world where Bahamians may be going, whether it's into the UK or it's into the Middle East or in the United States, it is the duty of the government to inform its citizens to be aware and to be conscious. So I think what it did was it raised a consciousness. For us, we get travel advisories and coming to the Bahamas all the time. It's no secret that we are a small country, but we do have a crime problem. And a lot of times Americans are advised about coming here. And so we are many times a recipient of those U.S. travel advisories. And so when this was issued, a lot of Bahamians, you know, saw it for what it was. You know, we are now taking proactive steps to protect our citizens, just as America does all the time.
Mm. Journalist Jerome Sawyer in Nassau, Bahamas, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Still ahead, David Cameron might want to either check his mic or take some music theory. We'll tell you why later here on The World.
Support for The World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from finance's role in addressing climate change to the implications of central bank policy decisions, tune into Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
Marco Werman, It's the World. There's been trouble brewing in the South China Sea for years. After all, you've got some of the world's busiest shipping lanes, potentially huge amounts of oil and natural gas. And here's the problem. Beijing claims that 90% of those waters belong to China. But Malaysia, the Philippines, Taiwan, and Vietnam, they've all made territorial claims of their own. And it's a major source of growing tension. Today, an international tribunal in The Hague issued its first legal ruling on the dispute. The world's former China correspondent Mary Kay Magsad says the outcome was a major legal victory for the Philippines, which brought the case against China.
So this was a unanimous ruling that China had basically overstepped in building artificial islands in the South China Sea, in claiming that basically almost all of the South China Sea is historically China's and belongs to China. The ruling said that even if that were the case, and that's up for dispute, the 200-mile exclusive economic zone that belongs to each country, which is recognized by China in international protocols, should be recognized above any such historical claims. Now, the Chinese government is saying, we don't recognize this ruling. You have no jurisdiction over us, even though China has in the past agreed to follow the jurisdiction of the court in various agreements that it has signed.
So did the court say that the Philippines, Taiwan, and Vietnam and Malaysia all have a certain chunk of this South China Sea, and so does China? Did they divide it up?
That still needs to be decided in terms of which parts of the South China Sea belong to whom. And there are overlapping claims. But what the court did say is there is a 200-mile exclusive economic zone that has to be adjudicated when there are overlapping 200-mile exclusive economic zones. But what isn't the case is that China can claim territory and sea and shoals and islands that are many hundreds of miles away from China's coast. And it's not the first time that China's done something like this. When China has had disputes with North Korea, it has come up with a novel claim that China's sea rights extend to the furthest point to which Chinese silt goes, you know, on the ocean floor. No one else makes this claim in the world. China made this up. But that's what they say. And they don't recognize that right for anyone else, nor do they recognize historical claims for anyone else.
China's foreign minister called the ruling a farce. China didn't even have any representatives at this hearing in The Hague. Do they take this ruling seriously, or are they just going to keep on building islands now?
I think both. I think China always takes it seriously when it feels that it's being disrespected internationally, or when there's international opprobrium. China wants to be respected in the world. It wants its claims to be recognized internationally. That's why China has put in so much effort to make sure that the UN Human Rights Commission does not sanction China. It puts a lot of effort into that. So does it care about this ruling? It absolutely does. Is it going to recognize it? Unlikely. Is it going to have an effect on China's neighbors and others in the region as they look to see, well, what kind of regional leader is China going to be? Yeah, I think it will. I mean, if you go back a decade when I was based in Beijing and was doing a series on how China's neighbors and traditional U.S. allies in the region saw China's rise, it was very positive in most places, except maybe Japan. There was a feeling that the United States was focused on terrorism. China was focused on economic prosperity for all. This was a peaceful rise. Everybody wins. Well, in the last 5 years or so, as China has become more muscular in asserting its rights to the South China Sea, regional neighbors have had second thoughts and have said, you know, actually, we do see an important role for the United States in this region, which also annoys China to no end.
Yeah, great point. And is that going to raise tensions between China and the United States now?
Well, I think neither China nor the United States wants a war. You know, the two countries remain economically interdependent. They also work well together on a number of other issues. And the Chinese government, even under Xi Jinping, who has tended to be more nationalistic and more aggressive, he also is pragmatic. And he has found ways to work with the Obama administration, for instance, on climate change agreements and trade agreements, and that will probably continue. The question is, as China's economy slows down, there was always speculation. As long as I've been covering China over more than 20 years, there's been speculation that if things really started to turn sour within China, if the economy slowed down, if the population got restive and wanted more rights than the party wanted to give it, would the government then turn to some nationalistic cause to try to get the population behind it? I keep that as a question. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen now. But I am saying that with the government drawing a line and saying, this will not stand, we will not recognize this, two things could be going on. One is that they could be setting a marker and saying, you know, in the future, we might have to fight for this, for China's international dignity and pride. But the other is that the Chinese government recognizes that it can't be seen to be backing down by its own population, many of whom have been brought up with this nationalistic rhetoric with the Patriotic Education Campaign. And so if the government backs down and says, oh, so you're saying this isn't ours after all that effort we put into it, after building all those artificial islands and chasing away Philippine and Vietnamese ships and sometimes actually firing on them, you know, it makes the government look weak. It makes China look weak, and they can't afford to do that.
Well, people in the Philippines are celebrating this ruling, not surprisingly. But Mary Kay, if the UN has no way to enforce this decision, what does it really mean?
Well, it means that the international community isn't going to roll over just because China says we're the rising power and so you have to do things the way we want you to do them. And I think the Chinese government is actually kind of annoyed that the international community is not making more room for China's rise. Within the Chinese government, there's this feeling of inevitability. You know, it is our time, it is our century. And if you do anything to try to stop us from doing what we think we should be doing, then you're trying to contain China, and this is grossly unfair, and this is just a continuation of the 100 years of humiliation at the hands of foreign powers, which is a narrative that the Chinese government constantly tells and retells to its population. So what does it mean in terms of what China does now? That's still very unclear, and I think the Chinese government is probably keeping its options open. What does it mean in terms of how the Chinese government thinks it's being seen now? I think it feels that it's just been slapped down, and certainly it's got to feel a sting from that.
Mary Kay Magstad, who hosts our podcast, Whose Century Is It? Great to speak with you, Mary Kay. Thanks.
Great to speak with you too, Marco.
A quick note now, yet another controversy from the South China Sea region, and it's got nothing to do with the maritime dispute. Hainan Island, undisputed Chinese territory, the southernmost point of China between Hong Kong and Vietnam, a new species of beetle was discovered there last year. And to the Prague-based Chinese entomologist who discovered it goes the privilege of naming said beetle. This species of beetle eats rotten wood. So Cheng Bin Wang named it after Chinese President Xi Jinping. Mr. Wang apparently said that President Xi is the same as the beetle. He fights corruption. The Chinese censors, though, view the presidentially named beetle as a presidential insult, and so they blocked searches for the beetle's new Chinese name on the popular microblogging site Weibo. You won't find it on Chinese search engines either. News is next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Brexit means there may be some big changes heading for Britain. I mean, even the typeface used on the London Underground is getting a facelift.
We hope that the new typeface is not as catastrophic as Brexit. So let's just start with that.
Keep calm and carry on a new font. That's coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. It's worth reminding ourselves on the day that Bernie Sanders endorses his one-time rival Hillary Clinton that these are unprecedented times. Hillary Clinton is set to become the first female presidential nominee from a major party, vying to become the first woman as president of the United States. In Britain, a female leader is not unprecedented. First, there was Margaret Thatcher, and now there's Theresa May. I asked my BBC colleague Jane Garvey to tell us about the new prime minister in waiting.
She is 59 years of age. She has been the Home Secretary in David Cameron's government for 6 years. And being Home Secretary is a notoriously difficult position. Essentially, you're in charge of homeland security. So terrorism is part of your brief. Prisons, justice, all sorts of other issues come under Theresa May, or did come under Theresa May. It's very, very difficult to be popular in that role. It's a job usually you fail in, and after a couple of years, you're shipped out. But Theresa May has survived. She's regarded as a very steady woman. She's calm. Some people say her problem is that she lacks charisma. But I think that's about the harshest criticism you could throw at her.
Let me ask you about one position of Theresa May's that I think a lot of Americans will find relevant right now. She criticized policing and police misconduct in Britain in a famous speech in 2014. What did she say?
Well, it is really interesting because the Home Secretary, that's why I said at the beginning, is such a toxic job. It never seems to lead anywhere. She is a really rare example of someone who's gone on to be promoted after being Home Secretary. Dealing with the police is never easy, as I know plenty of people in the States will appreciate right now. And she went into the lion's den, if you like, and addressed a meeting of the police union in Britain and basically told them they had to get their act together, that they were really dealing far too harshly with people, with non-white people in Britain, that they were having a very tough time at the hands of the police. And there's something, or there was something, called Stop and Search. And the police in various parts of the UK where we have a high ethnic minority population were simply stopping and searching people. I say people, but overwhelmingly they were stopping and searching young black men. Mm. And Theresa May actually socked it to them. She went to the Police Federation and said, change your ways. And if you don't, I'll make sure that you do.
Yeah, have things changed because of what she said?
I think it made her very unpopular with the police. I think that's fair to say, or some of the police. I think there's no doubt that this is something that she is really keen to tackle. And she was prepared to make herself really unpopular. And I think, again, this is something that even people way to the left of Theresa May have grudging respect. You can't deny the woman's courage.
Let me ask you the woman question, Jane, because it's a big deal that the presumed Democratic nominee here is a woman.
Yes.
And Hillary just got her endorsement from Bernie Sanders today.
I know.
But they're in the UK. You've been through this before with Margaret Thatcher. Is it still a big deal that Britain has a female leader, about to have a female leader again?
You know what? It depends how old you are. So I'm 52, and I'm happy to say that when I was a 14-year-old schoolgirl, I stayed up all night to wait for Margaret Thatcher to become Prime Minister back in 1979. So now we've moved on. It's 2016. We haven't had a female Prime Minister since Margaret Thatcher, who left in 1990. I've got two teenage daughters, and they're a bit interested in the fact that the Prime Minister is a woman from tomorrow. But to them, it's just, why not? And I don't think it's that unusual. And obviously, we are really interested in what's going on in the States. We're following the story of Hillary Clinton. We can't quite see what the problem is. And also, of course, we've had the Queen as our head of state for all of our lives, really. So we don't really get the woman problem, I don't think.
Is there a sense right now with Theresa May that the women have had to come in and clear up the mess made by, Boris, David and Nigel?
It would be lovely to think it were that simple. I present this long-running show on the BBC called Woman's Hour. We've been talking about women and women's issues for 70 years. We would love to believe it were a case of women coming up to clear up the mess that men have made. I think we all know that women are actually just as capable of making a mess. I would like to think it wasn't true. We know it. Women do make a mess. And there are bad female politicians and there are bad male politicians. I think Theresa May is a pretty steady pair of hands. That's how she's regarded here. Mm.
So final question, Jane, what kind of tone can we expect from a Theresa May-led Britain after this tumultuous exit from the EU? Will it be humble or more of a continuation of the we're better than Europe attitude that led to Brexit in the first place?
Well, of course, the difficult thing, which you've already mentioned, is that nearly half the population voted to stay in the European Union. So you're right. I mean, I have never known an issue in my years in journalism that has excited so much public debate. There are conversations at bus stops, on trains, in pubs, everywhere. People are still talking about this. I think a lot of people feel that Theresa May will lead a reasonably self-confident Britain, but she will be able to deal with other European leaders in a fairly humble, self-deprecating way. It's great that she isn't this big, showy, brash politician, but I think she'll probably have the measure of Angela Merkel. Her supporters certainly think so anyway, and that's going to be really, really interesting, these key meetings between these two really pivotal, important women over the next couple of years.
My BBC colleague Jane Garvey, presenter of Women's Hour, telling us about Theresa May, the next British Prime Minister, starting tomorrow. Jane, thank you very much.
Thank you.
As for outgoing Prime Minister David Cameron, his final hours in office don't seem to be getting any easier. Yesterday, as you may know, he didn't realize his microphone was still on. He'd just given his speech about handing over power to Theresa May, and as he walked back toward number 10 Downing Street, the mic picked up the sound of Cameron humming a happy tune.
Right.
Right. The sound of a man who seems almost glad to be done with it all, except the composers won't let him rest. Those four notes he hummed at 10 Downing have inspired a whole bunch of riffs and variations. One composer used Cameron's humming to create a Darth Vader-like orchestral march. Have a listen to this.
Right.
And here's another. A DJ named Ingi mixed this one up.
I think it's caught the British imagination in the sense that music can say things that words can't.
That's London-based composer Thomas Hewitt-Jones. He says the Cameron hum has got quite a few composers giving Cameron's trials and tribulations a musical interpretation.
It's fantastic that everyone's reacting in a different way. There's been, I gather, a hip-hop reaction to it. I haven't actually listened to it yet because I'm a little bit underslept today. And there's also somebody who's improvised a Baroque fugue or a sort of fuguetta. What I find fascinating is that every single piece of art, every reaction is different. And that's the beauty of art, isn't it? You can experience it in any way.
The reason Jones is a little short on sleep, he was up all night writing his own composition around Cameron's theme. He says the Prime Minister didn't give him much to go on. He started on an E flat and three notes later ended on D and then said right. But it was enough to get started.
It sort of inspired me to try and react to it. If you look at what he sang in a minor key. And often major key is a very happy feeling, but a minor key can almost represent an emotion of discontent. I sort of picked on that.
This is Thomas Hewitt-Jones' fantasy on David Cameron, reflecting the mood of many Brits now.
In uncertain times, such as the Brexit situation, I think people do turn to art. So I think this Cameron event has been a real eye-opener. It's been very interesting to see the response to it.
The response on social media has been off the charts. Hundreds of thousands of views and more musical interpretations at every turn.
Right.
We can't resist. Here's one more variation on the theme.
Thank you very much. Right. Thank you very much.
Four casual notes, and that's what you get, Mr. Prime Minister. Well, even though Britain is going through a lot of changes with a soon-to-be new Prime Minister and Brexit, some things are still the same.
Mind the gap. Stand clear of the doors, please.
The London Underground, the Tube. You still have to mind the gap, but the typeface used to designate the Circle and Piccadilly lines on the London Underground is changing. It's called Johnston, and it's undergoing a makeover. Nadine Shaheen is type director at Monotype, and she's here to tell us more about London's new look, Johnston 100. So Transport of London hired your firm Monotype to make this change. Nadine, I'm sure it was in the works for a while, but at a time when big changes for Britain are so controversial, why do this?
Well, first of all, we hope that the new typeface is not as catastrophic as Brexit. So let's just start with that. It just happens that the launch of the typeface and the referendum were very close in time, but they are completely unrelated events.
Sure.
So, and I do hope that the, you know, experience of going through the Tube and experiencing the new typeface is not going to be as traumatic as pulling out of the European Union. So,
still, though, it's such an identifiable,
absolutely,
known typeface.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
Why the project to change it?
Yes. Well, actually, this is the funny part. So in a way, we are changing, but in a way, we are going back to the original design of this typeface. And this typeface had served really well the Transport for London for 100 years. But during that time, it had started to move gradually, bit by bit, away from the original design. And, you know, coming back to the present, Transport for London had reviewed what the typeface is now looking like. And they had this wish to go back to the original design of the typeface to maintain that original soul of it. So in a way, it's a change, but it's a change back to the roots.
So tell us of what that new font, or rather old font, the original font, actually yes. looks like.
Yes. So the original typeface had slightly wider proportions than what was now in use up until the present time.
Thicker line?
It takes a little bit more space, so in the width of it. Slight modifications had been done on the typeface. For example, when we're looking at the top arches of letters like the M, the N, the H, over time there had been more corrections done to them so that the intersection of the arch and the vertical is a little bit more tapered, which is not that way in the original design. So all of these little modifications that were done to the typeface had, you know, changed it away from that original design. And the new typeface, the Johnston 100, tries to bring that original design intention back.
It sounds pretty nuanced. Do you think the average transit rider will notice the changes?
On the regular weights, not so much. I mean, except if they're sharp-eyed and then they notice that the G in this typeface is different from the G in the other typeface. The G is a big giveaway, the lowercase g. But if you compare the regular with the other regular, it's very nuanced. So maybe a sharp-eyed graphic designer will be able to, you know, maybe notice the difference.
Well, to get a better sense of what it actually looks like, we've got images up at PRI.org that listeners can check out. It occurs to me, Nadine, that things like the hashtag or the at sign, things that weren't largely used 100 years ago when Johnson was first introduced, you've got to accommodate for that too, I suppose.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this was part of the original brief. So we were asked to design a new hashtag, to take a look again at the at sign. Mm. And with that, we reviewed it. We, you know, made it fit more with the design and, you know, more in harmony with the rest of the typeface. And of course, at this day and age, these are extremely important.
When the original Johnson first came out 100 years ago, what was the reaction to it then? Did it look really modern for people?
Yeah, I mean, it was a breakthrough, I think, in design communication for two reasons. One, it was the first of its kind in terms of this blend between geometry and humanist design. Unbelievable achievement in terms of design skill and vision, but also because of its consistency of usage within the overall Transport for London design system. It's part of the success of the typeface, the design itself, but also how consistently it's been used.
Well, precisely to that point, I mean, Johnston, the font, has just been such a huge part of London's visual identity. How do Londoners feel about this change?
Well, we've just released it just a couple of weeks ago. It hasn't made its way into the tube yet, so the actual stations. It will be part of the Elizabeth line, which is a new line. It will open, I think, in 2018, but it will be used in posters and in digital communication as of July. The project has been heavily covered here in the UK, and people have been very positive with their feedback. Like, if you look on social media, if you look for, you know, hashtag Johnston100, the feedback has been unbelievably positive. Many people are interested within the design world and also outside of the design world.
Nadine Shaheen is type director of Monotype in London, which is in charge of the font makeover for the London Underground. Nadine, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Just ahead, when refugees get to Germany and face a new round of harassment from other refugees. But it's not all about tensions and differences in Europe. We'll also hear about three artists from different parts of the world making music in a Danish cafe.
A Swedish guy and a Mozambican guy and a Danish guy, you know, they're speaking one language, which is the music language. So that's what we want to reflect to the society. That is possible.
That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The images of people in flight from this past year are hard to forget. More than 1 million migrants and refugees crossing into Turkey, boarding boats for Greece, and then making their way to Germany. Among them were Christians who fled violence and persecution back home in Iraq and Syria. Many of them have found some refuge in Germany, but some Christian refugees say they've also faced harassment from other refugees. Daniel Estrin heard some of their stories in Berlin.
Whose beer is this? Tarek Bakhus said his roommate asked when he opened the fridge. German authorities arrange housing for Syrian refugees. They assigned Tariq to an apartment with 9 other Syrian refugees. He was the only Christian, the only one in the apartment who drank beer. The others were Sunni Muslims from Syria. Devout Muslims don't drink alcohol. Tariq says his roommate was annoyed. So Tariq replied, "If you think beer is forbidden, why did you come to Germany? You know, a land of beer." He says his roommate told him, "We are the majority in this house. If you don't like it, you can go." Eventually, he did. The Christian organization Open Doors Germany says it interviewed more than 200 Christian migrants in Germany this year from Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. It says 88% of them reported being targeted by other migrants because of their religion. The organization says most people reported insults. Some reported physical attacks, even a few death threats. In some cases, this is happening to members of the world's oldest Christian communities. I spoke with Tariq in the pews of his church, the Syriac Orthodox Church in Berlin. The church liturgy here is in Syriac, a dialect of Aramaic, the language Jesus spoke. Tariq's ancient Christian community is dwindling in Syria. He says he came to Germany in September because his Christian neighborhood near the city of Homs was attacked by rebels. I met another member of the church, Wasim Awad. He used to be a veterinarian in Mishrafi, a village of Christians and Alawites near Homs. Wasim says his village supported the Syrian government. Opposition rebels surrounded the village. He says Christians and Alawites in his village were kidnapped and killed. So Wasim left for Germany and ended up at a refugee shelter. The majority of the refugees there were Sunni Muslims. Wasim says he overheard some of them boasting that they weren't fleeing persecution, but that they were there to spread political Islam in Europe. He claims he even heard people praising Daesh, ISIS, and also the Al-Qaeda affiliate Jabhat al-Nusra. Once, Wissam says, I went to a police officer stationed at the refugee shelter. I told him, "We came from Syria. We are fleeing ISIS and al-Nusra. And you put us with ISIS and al-Nusra." The police said, "It's Germany. They have a right to free speech. There's nothing we can do." I visited a refugee center in Berlin, and I asked Birgit Schulz, the German administrator who runs it, how she deals with religious difference. We sat in the courtyard that's surrounded by dormitories. Kids played in the playground. Women wearing headscarves peeked out of windows. She says her refugee center is small, only about 400 people, and she hasn't had the religious conflicts that more crowded centers have. She says she tries to avoid assigning people of different religions to live in the same room, but she will put a Christian and a Muslim together if the alternative is putting them with people who don't speak their language. But some refugee center directors don't even pay attention to religion, says a former refugee center director, Thomas de Vacroix. He says the Berlin government prints forms that refugees fill out when they register at a housing center. The forms, he says, ask for their name, birth date, and country of origin, but not their religion.
Das ist Deutschland. Datenschutz ist wichtig.
This is Germany, de Vacroix says. Religion is considered a private matter. Perhaps, he says, Germany is haunted by the memory of Nazi anti-Semitism and doesn't want to discriminate based on religion. But he believes the opposite happens. He says disregarding religious difference actually leads to some migrants experiencing discrimination and harassment. Thomas de Vacroix had his own solution to these problems when he was directing a refugee center. The large silver ring decorated with a cross that he wears on his finger. He says his ring made the Christian refugees in his center feel he had their backs. For The World, Daniel Estrin, Berlin.
Let's flip that coin now and go to Denmark, where we found this story about people from different cultures pulling together musically. It happened during the Copenhagen Jazz Festival this month, where a cafe became a meeting point for a drummer, singer from Mozambique, a piano player from Sweden, and another singer, a woman adopted from Swaziland, who now lives in Denmark. Here's a snapshot from Copenhagen.
I'm Diodato Sikir, a musician from Mozambique. My music took me to Scandinavia. It was a rebirth for me. Today we're going to have the Afro World Jam Session. We're going to play all kinds of things from all over the world. Everybody's going to be here. The Swedish guy and a Mozambican guy and a Danish guy, you know, they're speaking one language, which is the music language. So that's what we want to reflect to the society. That is possible.
Are you like up or down?
I'm Maria Tandi. My daddy is a Zulu and my mom is actually from Swaziland. But I was gifted to come here to Denmark and I stayed with this Danish family. I'm brought up with gospel and blues. Of course, there's also some African inspirations into that. So I'm kind of mixing it. And then I'm really a storyteller. So I think that's like my thing. I need the crowd. And then whatever they bring, I'll have that conversation by singing. We do what we do best on stage, and it's like we're having this conversation with our instruments and getting to know each other by what we love the most. And for me, that's magic. Yeah, I love it.
My name is David Beck, and I'm coming from Gothenburg, Sweden. When we play the music, people in the audience feel like this is like my kitchen at home with the family, and we talk in a sweet way together. African music is so rhythmical and ecstatic, so it's good for me when it's like take some breaks and just relax, and then you go with the energy again. And it was fantastic in that way, I think.
Great sounds and vibes from Cafe Blue Team in Copenhagen. They came courtesy of producer Sonja Narang. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being with us.
PRI, Public Radio International.